Good evening. Welcome to Upper House. My name is Dan Hummel. I'm on staff here at the S.L. Brown Foundation, and it's my pleasure tonight to get straight to our event and to introduce our speaker, Dr. Gavin Ortlund. Gavin is a scholar and author whose voice has become a trusted guide for many in the church today. He holds a Ph.D. in historical theology from Fuller Theological Seminary. His work reflects a deep commitment to both biblical fidelity and theological clarity, grounded in the history of Christian thought and a spirit of pastoral humility. Gavin is probably known to most of us through his books and his YouTube channel, Truth Unites, where he tackles complex theological issues, including long-standing questions, as well as topics of the moment, ranging from the historical legacy of John Wycliffe to whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God. I'm going to read here his last three videos posted in the last few days to just illustrate some of the topics. Atheism is devastating and unlivable. Christ's ascension is stranger than you think. And these AI videos raise a theology question. So Gavin, along with being on YouTube, is the author of several books on some of these topics that he covers on his channel. These include titles like Why God Makes Sense in a World That Doesn't, What It Means to Be Protestant, Theological Retrieval for Evangelicals, and The Art of Disagreeing. And I'll talk about it at the end, but we have The Art of Disagreeing here available for purchase tonight. Gavin comes to us tonight to talk about how to be a Christian witness for a disenchanted world, where he will share with us the hope available in a grim landscape of spiritual emptiness, cultural shallowness, and social isolation. Terms like anxiety and depression dominate our conversations, but Gavin encourages us to see the opportunities in the landscape and the beauty of the Christian message within it. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gavin Ortlund.
Well, it's wonderful to be here with you all. I've been looking forward to tonight, especially. I've loved my time here in Madison and looking forward to having some time to interact, and I'll stick around afterwards and would love to get to know some of you. We'll have plenty of time for questions and comments and interaction and engagement on the things that we're going to talk about. So I'll look forward to that. Let me boil down in one word what I hope you feel and experience based upon what we work through tonight, and that is the word hope. I hope you feel hope personally, and I hope you feel that for what we are to do in the strange times that we live in. Let me start with a question. You don't have to answer, but just think about it. Maybe you could pick an adjective or something like that for how you'd answer this. What does the world feel like right now? Don't say out loud. It'll be too depressing if we all start saying negative things all at once, but what are the emotions that are floating around in 2025? We could probably stack up a long list, and some of them positive, but I suspect that a lot of us would think of challenges and think of swirling forces around us that feel chaotic, that feel beyond our ability to control, and cause a lot of fear and angst in many of us. I have five young kids, ages 2 to 12. I think about the world I'm raising them in. I think I'm walking around the campus today, this beautiful campus, and thinking of it won't be too long before my kids start thinking about where they're going to be going to college, if God leads them to that. And I'm thinking about what they'll be facing, the pressures and temptations they'll be facing. I think we all feel the weight of the times in which we live. I want to throw out a word and see if this word resonates with you at all. It's the word disenchantment. We're going to define that word. We're going to describe what that is like and maybe some ways that we feel disenchanted without even realizing it. And then we're going to talk about the answer to that, that I believe is Jesus. And I'd like to just think about how Jesus Christ is the answer to disenchantment. But first, we've got to define what we're talking about here with this word disenchantment. So let me start with an illustration from one of C.S. Lewis's books. I wonder if any of you have read the book That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis. A couple of us. It's one of his stranger books. A lot of people start it thinking this will be just like the Chronicles of Narnia, really easy to read, and are in for a shock because it's a very strange book, kind of a dystopian book about the future and technology. And there's one particular scene that is very vivid and very dark, one of the characters named Mark is captured by the evil characters. And he's tortured, but it's not physical torture. It's a kind of psychological torture, or you could almost call it a kind of moral torture. He's put into a room where everything is just slightly off kilter. So the architecture and the doorway and the framing and the windows are just slightly crooked. Not wildly crooked and not in a rational way, but just everything's a little bit randomly off. There's paintings all around the walls, and some of them are kind of grotesque. Others look normal at first, and then as you're looking at the painting, you suddenly notice something odd, like the painting of the Last Supper, but then there's a bunch of beetles under the table. And basically, what is going on in this experience he's having is his evil captors are trying to break him down and cause him to lose his sense of moral instincts. But being in that room, let's call it the crooked room, just so when we refer back to this, we'll have it in our minds. Being in that room has the opposite effect upon him. I want to read to you the passage about what actually happens to him as his captors are trying to break him down. C.S. Lewis writes, "The built and painted perversity of this room had the effect of making him aware, as he'd never been before, of this room's opposite. As the desert first teaches men to love water, or as absence first reveals affection, there rose up against this background of the sour and the crooked some vision of the sweet and the straight. Something else that he vaguely called the normal apparently existed. He had never thought about it before, but there it was, solid, massive, with a shape of its own." And Lewis goes on for a while describing the normal as something that reminds him of sunlight and the thought that there's daytime going on somewhere outside. I'm really interested in us getting into the emotions of these big picture topics that we're going to work through tonight. I'm curious how that passage strikes you. Now, let me read you how Lewis describes him before he has this encounter with goodness that awakens him to transcendence and ultimately to God. But before that, C.S. Lewis describes his life as the dust and broken bottles, the heap of old tin cans, the dry and choking places. So I want us to have in our minds as we start out tonight these two different images, almost as one the most gray and drab as you can imagine, the dust and broken bottles, the heap of old tin cans, the dry and the choking places. That's Mark before this encounter. Afterwards, he has this encounter and it's the normal, the sweet, the straight. It's like sunlight, like the birds chirping. About as stark a contrast as you can imagine. What C.S. Lewis is ultimately describing is the kind of drabness and grayness that the modern world is moving towards. As soon as we get into this and I say that, I know some of us will think, really, is it that bad? I'm going to try to unpack why he sees things like that. Many of us feel that. Many of our friends around us, our friends and neighbors, feel that darkness, what we're going to call disenchantment, what I'm trying to describe as the heap of old tin cans, the dry and the choking places. Many of us, the anxiety, the depression is so high, the numbness to pleasure, the distraction, the clutter, it is real and it is pervasive around us. We're going to describe that as disenchantment. And then what I want us to think about tonight is how Jesus punctures that and invites us to something better, something that leads to hope, something that feels a little bit to every single one of us. It will come through in this way at some point or another, like the sweet and the straight and the normal and the wholesome and the sunlight and the birds chirping. Let me explain a little bit about why we call, following C.S. Lewis, the modern West, the dry and choking places. That is Lewis's description of some of the aspects that are around us in our culture. And if you're like me, when I first hear that, I feel like, boy, that seems kind of dismal. It seems a little harsh. There's a lot of great things about our culture. What is he really talking about when he says that? Let me get at it in this way. In his acclaimed book, A Secular Age, which some of you have read and more of you have probably just seen quotes from it because it's very long, Charles Taylor has a chapter called The Malaises of Modernity. Do you know that word malaise? I didn't know what this meant. I had to look it up. Malaise is kind of a general feeling of uneasiness that's hard to define. Mark, when he's in the crooked room, is feeling a lot of malaise. Okay. Charles Taylor talks about the malaises of modernity as this generalized despair. He calls it, well, he talks about it as a generalized despair or an ambiguous despair because he's talking about something that is not concretely in our minds. He's basically saying there's a feeling of despair in the modern world that we don't fully recognize and discern and see for what it is. And he says 500 years ago, it'd be very hard to explain this to anyone. Very few, think of it like this, people 500 years ago could in an individual circumstance feel despair, but there wasn't a generalized despair throughout the whole culture. What does he mean by generalized despair? He breaks it down in many ways, but at the heart of it is this feeling of meaninglessness. For all our wealth, for all our power, for all our technology, there is a malaise. There's an emptiness that is churning through our culture and through many of our own hearts. In none of what we say, by the way, are we looking down our noses at everyone as though the big bad culture is over there. All of us are enmeshed in these challenges that we face. At one point, Charles Taylor describes this feeling he's talking about as the idea that our actions and our goals and our achievements have a lack of weight or gravity or substance. I really hope we can orient ourselves to this topic at a personal level. I'll be humble enough to admit I know those emotions. Wonder if any of you do as well. Often they will sneak in moments of success. You know, it's been observed that many people are experiencing a midlife crisis earlier these days. And that's an interesting cultural phenomenon. People in their 30s, as they're climbing in their career, all of a sudden have one of those moments where they're asking, you know, what am I doing all of this for? I checked off this box, I checked off this box, I checked off this box. All of my goals have now been achieved. And this haunting question comes in is, well, now what? Sometimes the successful moments of life are the loneliest moments of all, where these deep questions come in. The word disenchantment comes up for us as a way to start to approach this emotion, this cultural reality that is the fallout of hundreds of years of development. And if we were going to do a deep dive on this, I know some professors from the university are here and we could talk this through at great length. But what we're really interested in is right now what it's resulted in here in the late modern world. So if we were to trace it out fully, we'd go back to famous philosophers like René Descartes and Immanuel Kant and note these pivotal movements in the modern West as it's developing. But really what we're at today is the late modern era, sometimes postmodern, here in the 21st century. And what it's all sort of resulted in is a sense of disenchantment. Let's try to understand that a little bit. By the way, as we think about culture, it helps to remember that culture is not the landscape, but the glasses. Meaning, culture has more to do with how we see than what we see. And therefore, we're very often not self-aware about how we're affected by our culture. It's really humbling, by the way, if you're a follower of Jesus like me and you're trying to be mindful about how the culture is affecting us around us, and you realize, wow, it's really got its tentacles into me more than I even realized. We'll all have moments like that. So could it be the case that people around us, and sometimes we ourselves, are experiencing a generalized despair without fully even consciously thinking about it? In his book, Making Sense of God, Tim Keller has a whole chapter on happiness. Amazing chapter. He's asking the basic question of, are we happy? And he's looking at it through the lens of the modern West. And he suggests that, I'll never forget, you ever have this experience, you're reading through a book and a sentence strikes you so much, you have to just put down the book and think about it for a second and think, is that true? He's putting it strongly, and I think he's right. He says that most of us are so unhappy that it takes years to even fully realize and take in the nature of the unhappiness. I thought, really? Is it that bad? And I started to think about it, and I started to think about, you know, what I just mentioned a moment ago, for example, the midlife crisis that comes in early. I started to think about some of the other suffering I knew and other friends around me. It started to make more sense. Here's the quote of what he says. On the whole, we are in denial about the depth and magnitude of our discontent. The artists and thinkers who talk about it most poignantly are seen as morbid outliers, but actually they are prophetic voices. It usually takes years to break through and dispel the denial in order to see the magnitude and dimension of our dissatisfaction in life. One of the things he's drawing attention to is what the philosopher Blaise Pascal called diversions. And this is this idea that we use entertainment and busyness and other forms of distraction so that we don't have to attend to the ultimate questions with which our heart is truly concerned. And he said there's two ultimate questions. Number one is meaning, and number two is death. Meaning is, what are we doing here? And death is, what happens when it's over? And his point was, isn't it interesting how rarely we actually face those questions squarely, look them in the eye, and really think it through? Many of us can go through our whole lives without really asking the ultimate questions, and diversions is one way we do that. Happiness is another one of them, kind of connected to meaning. Maybe as a way to personally orient ourselves to this topic, we can just, I'll put out a really basic question and let it see how this lands upon you just in the moment here as we're here. By the way, hope is coming. Remember, that's why I said at the beginning, we're getting to hope. I promise it's coming, okay? But we've got to maybe wrestle with where we're coming from to get there. But the simple question that is poignant and helpful to ask ourselves is, am I happy? Poignant question. Sometimes we distract ourselves from even asking it. Some of the older atheist philosophers talked about disenchantment in very vivid terms. One of those who is most disturbing in his diagnosis, you may have heard of, I wish I should have put a picture up because he's got a great beard, but Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, his whole project is about atheism, and specifically what he calls the death of God, which means the loss of God and God's role in Western civilization. And what he's basically saying is, this is a real problem. One of his provocative passages addressing this, he's put, most people think it's describing Nietzsche himself. He's a character going into a market and he's saying, where is God? We have killed him, all of us. We are his murderers. But how did we do this? And now listen to how he describes this. It's quite striking. How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? I'll stop there. I've got more of the passage, but he's stacking up these metaphors about the earth being unchained from the sun, straying through an infinite nothing. Perhaps the simplest, most poignant sentence in there is there still any up or down? Now, the reason before we get to hope, I think it's good to kind of land in this and think about this reality of disenchantment, this sense of a loss of meaning and transcendence in the modern West, is because I think we need to really appreciate the fact that many people around us feel that way. They are saying in their hearts, maybe diverting themselves with distractions so they're not saying it consciously, is there still any up or down? That paragraph vividly captures the sense of it. The other existentialist philosophers used other metaphors for this. Today, some of us were talking about the French philosopher Albert Camus and his book, The Myth of Sisyphus. Wonder if anybody has read this book out there, is familiar with Sisyphus? Are you familiar with this character from Greek mythology? Some of you know that name. Sisyphus was doomed to roll a stone up a hill for all eternity without ever actually reaching the top, so that continually he's striving but not attaining his goal. And Camus basically was saying, that's human life. It is a struggle. It is labor. And there's never really a resting point that you arrive upon. And he said that's the consequence of atheism. The other great existentialist philosopher, Jean-Paul Sartre, put it like this. He said, once you lose God, you lose any sense of objective good. There were other atheists in his day who thought you could discard God and retain a robust sense of right and wrong. His opinion about that was as follows. He says, I find it extremely embarrassing that God does not exist, for there disappears with him all possibility of finding values in an intelligible heaven. There can no longer be good a priori, since there is no infinite and perfect consciousness to think it. And he quotes approvingly the line from the famous Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky, if God does not exist, then all things are permitted. That simple quote from Dostoevsky's book, The Brothers Karamazov, gets right at the heart of what we're talking about with disenchantment. And the atheist philosophers, like these existentialists, like Nietzsche, are saying this is the thread that comes through once you have lost God. You start with the loss of God, and then you watch as it rumbles on for a few hundred years, and what you end up with is a sense of disenchantment. Think of disenchantment as the loss of any sort of transcendent moorings, so that you're asking, like the passage in Nietzsche, is there still any up or down? And what I would like to propose is that a lot of people around us in our culture feel that on some level, even if we can't articulate it. There's a sense of generalized despair, there's a sense of ambiguity, and there's a sense of, is there still any up or down? To illustrate this, think of the following thought experiment. Imagine that you took a 21st century human being from Manhattan, put them in a time machine 1,000 years back to a monastery in Western Europe, and then you took one of the monks in the monastery, put him in the time machine, and sent him 1,000 years ahead to Manhattan. Okay, so the monk is in walking around Times Square, and the 21st century person is now having to live in the monastery. Which one will be more shocked? Which one will have a tougher time coming to terms with their new setting? Which one will be more offended? Which will be more disgusted? Which is more likely to flourish and survive? Now, this is a tough thing. I remember thinking about this thought experiment for a while and thinking, you know, obviously it's going to be a shock for this person to go back 1,000 years to the medieval West, and we don't want to romanticize the past. There's all kinds of brokenness in the world at that time. But I suspect that concerning the most important matters of the human soul, things concerning happiness, goodness, and meaning, that monk's sense of disorientation in our world would be deeper and more profound. We have greater technology today, but we are lonelier. We have longer lifespans, but we have higher suicide rates. We've rejected superstitions, but we've also lost faith. Our world is flashier, but that world 1,000 years ago had a meaning and a stability and an order that we sometimes don't even realize we've lost. Let me give an example of something that's a little bit in the periphery here, and that's the phenomenon of loneliness. So I've been studying and thinking about our culture for a long time now, and I'm fascinated by our culture. I love where we live. I love the many benefits of living in this nation at this time, of course. I'm very grateful for all the good. But I'm very interested in these deeper matters of why we're having such an epidemic of anxiety and depression, and just what is floating around, and what do we do about that, especially because I have a fatherly heart to try to be a friend to Gen Z. I love Gen Z. I want to serve them and give my life for them, really. And they are suffering. They are suffering tremendously with mental health issues and many other matters, and I'm interested in that. One of the things I've come to be aware of is the reality of loneliness and just how pervasive this is. This is one of those things, maybe when we think of the challenges of our world, we wouldn't immediately recognize, but it's there and starts to bubble up the more we think about things. We may not even be aware of how lonely we are. Many people within our culture have no friends with whom they can honestly share their heart and say, what's basically not working in my life? Can I talk about it with you? which is a basic human need. As I studied, I think of a monk from 1,000 years ago because I did my doctoral dissertation studying one of them. And one of the things that amazed me most about his theology was his doctrine of friendship. Because his view was basically that it is possible for two souls to be I'll quote his words, to be welded into one by the fires of love. And he would write these letters to other monks, agonizing at their physical separation, saying it's as though my heart is being torn into pieces. He has this idea that two friends can be welded into one, be united, almost sort of, if you know the idea in the Trinity, there's a word that talks about how the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the three persons of the Godhead, have this kind of mutual indwelling with each other. He uses that kind of language to describe his love for his friends. Can I just give you an example? This is something sometimes you're studying something for one reason and something comes in sideways and completely blindsides you. That's what happened here. I read this sentence to another monk. He says, "Since your soul and mine can by no means endure to be absent from each other, but are incessantly entwined together, there is nothing in us that is missing from each other except that we are not present to each other bodily." I read that sentence. It was another moment of put down the book and think about it for an hour. Go on a walk and let that one percolate. We have everything in common except we're not physically present. We share everything. I mean, that's what he says. We are nothing and missing in us from each other except that we are not present to each other bodily. And I thought, that is something that we have profoundly lost. You know, think of the characters Sam and Frodo in The Lord of the Rings and the way they love each other. Think of David and Jonathan in the Bible, the way they love each other. What I discovered as I started getting into this is that only our culture in all human history exalts romantic and sexual love as the highest form of love. What I was getting in this particular medieval monk is just ancient approaches to relationship. In the ancient world, friendship was the highest form of love, even though they had a very exalted view of marriage. C.S. Lewis puts it like this in his book, The Four Loves, quote, "To the ancients, friendship seemed the happiest and most human of all the loves, the crown of life and the school of virtue. The modern world, in comparison, ignores it. It is something quite marginal, not a main course in life's banquet, a diversion, something that fills up the chinks of one's time." And I'll never forget thinking about that and thinking, well, no wonder we have so many struggles when we have lost this idea of friendship. And that's one of those that I don't think we're even as consciously aware of as much. Those of you who are followers of Jesus, like myself, I think we need to put our heads together and really think through, how do we help our culture in this respect? How do we model and promote and encourage really healthy, wonderful, life-giving friendships that can be like oil in the engine to our whole culture and can reduce some of the antagonism and reduce some of the mental health issues and just help across the board, because everybody needs friends, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. So that's just one example of the kind of generalized climate that's come about as there's been this colossal, I will say, the loss of God. The writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, when he won the Templeton Prize, was giving his acceptance speech in 1973, and he was talking about 20th century violence, and he famously said, "All this has happened because people have forgotten God." And what I'm proposing is that that is true for 21st century disenchantment and despair, anxiety epidemics, depression, and the generalized feeling of numbness and meaninglessness that is swirling around us. All of this ultimately traces back to a forgetting of God. Well, what do we do about that? Let's give some hope. I hope that we will feel personally hope in response to this. And then I hope we will feel equipped rather than afraid to speak out words of hope to those around us. Sometimes when we see the dire needs around us, we can be tempted to withdraw out of fear. What I would love to encourage us towards is a sense of leaning in with love and hope and excitement. So let me suggest, even though this is not formulaic and we will need to ask for God's help in the process, let me suggest just two starting points for us for what we do about the phenomenon of despair and disenchantment around us, and then we'll talk more in the Q&A time. Number one, start with the transcendence of God. Sometimes when we think about bringing hope to people, those of you who are followers of Jesus like me, we think immediately of the message about Jesus. forgiveness of sins and the cross. One of the things that I've reflected upon a great deal is that we can learn from Paul's speech in Acts chapter 17. So in the Bible, the Apostle Paul is preaching in these different contexts, and it's amazing to see how different all of his sermons are one from another. When he's speaking in a Jewish synagogue, the sermon goes one way, and when he's speaking in a pagan context, the sermon goes very differently. And in Acts 17, he's speaking in Athens, in a famous intellectual gathering spot. You could think of it like an ancient university of sorts, and it's called the Areopagus in Athens. You can still go there today. And people would gather and discuss and debate ideas, and Paul stands up and preaches the gospel. And his sermon is very different because he has to start way further back. And he starts with the basic idea of God. And he's telling people something that we need to be able to point people towards today. And that is, there is a transcendent, personal creator. He made you. I hope you can still hear me, okay? If you can't, don't tell me and I'll just keep on going. hopefully it's still okay. He made you, he loves you, and he is as close as your next breath. And what Paul is saying in this chapter, he speaks of God's sheer transcendence, but also how close and intimate he is to each one of us. That's where Paul starts. John Stott, commenting on that passage, says this: many people today reject the gospel not because they perceive it to be false, but because they perceive it to be trivial. People are looking for an integrated worldview which makes sense of all their experience. We learn from Paul that we cannot preach the gospel of Jesus without the doctrine of God. People today around us are feeling the same thing. They're looking for an integrated worldview that can explain the deepest recesses of their heart. They're looking for something that goes down into those deepest emotions of shame and need. Think about it like this. You know, think about this deep. In a book I'm working on right now, I start up the whole book talking about what I call the ache. The ache is when you're listening to a beautiful strain of music and a longing for something beyond this world comes over you that you can't possibly articulate to anyone else. You ever felt something like that? The ache is when you have a nostalgic memory rush back to you unexpectedly, and it seizes you with emotion, and you're wondering, what does this mean? The ache is when you experience, some of us sadly have never experienced this one, you experience genuine reconciliation with someone that you did not expect, so much so that it really feels like a miracle. What kind of particular joy does that produce in your heart? For me, the ache comes when I'm on a walk at night and I hear the wind blowing through the leaves in the trees. And a longing fills my heart that I can't possibly put into words. And it feels as though the leaves are saying something very important. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? The ache, the longing for something more, something beyond. We need to preach a gospel that speaks to that because people are there. There's a scene in the book, The Wind of the Willows. Do you remember this old book where two of the characters encounter? I was going to say this scene in The Wind of the Willows where two of the characters see. They reach a mountain where they experience transcendence, and it says that they're filled with fear such that they're shaking, but at the same time, they're tremendously glad. Have you ever experienced something that makes you at the same time afraid and happy? That's related to the ache, the longing in your heart for something beyond what this world can explain. We need to preach a gospel that touches that. And that means starting with the transcendence of God. That means starting with the sheer glory and wonder of who God is. That also means being patient in the process of sharing the hope of Jesus with people. Throughout church history, a lot of people come to Christ in a very slow and complicated process. C.S. Lewis himself became a theist in 1929, and the famous passage in Surprised by Joy, where he says he was the most dejected convert in all of England. Some of you have heard of that passage. He was not a Christian yet. It took him two more years. 1931, he's a Christian. Augustine of Hippo, the greatest theologian in the early church. Spent, oh, how long was it? About 10 years as a Manichaean. And then there's a process where he's basically gets converted to Platonism. And then he becomes a Christian because he has to go through a series of steps just to awaken to the full categories of Christianity because he's not coming from a Christian background. We've got to start, like Paul does, back further with the basic idea of God that Paul does in Acts 17. We're in the Areopagus. We are not in the Jewish synagogue of Acts 13. We need to preach like Paul preached in Acts chapter 17. Second thing, we need to think about not just the truth of the gospel, but its beauty and goodness as well. The Greek philosophers spoke of the three transcendentals, the good, the true, and the beautiful. Historically, Christians have thought a great deal about all three and the importance of communicating the gospel as not just true, but as good and beautiful. And so often when we try to share the hope of Christ with others, we focus just on its truth, we give arguments for its truth, and we forget to speak to the ache. We forget to draw up the longing in the heart for goodness and beauty because people are aching for that all around us. Blaise Pascal famously gave a threefold strategy for commending God, especially the Christian God, for those who don't believe. He says, first, you have to show that this is reasonable, just to start the conversation. Second, you have to show that it's desirable. You have to make good people wish it were true. And third, you have to show that it actually is true. Many efforts at Christian witness today start at stage three. They're just trying to persuade by rational arguments. And they bypass some important steps of what we can call pre-evangelism sometimes. To think about how important this is, think about the last time you had an argument with a friend or with your spouse. How frequently does that get resolved just by a rational argument? Okay, if that doesn't resolve friend or marriage conflict, it probably won't be effective in evangelism either. We've got to start further back and speak to the heart. We've got to help people say, even if I'm not convinced yet, I wish that were true. That won't be the response we'll get from everybody, but from some people it will be because the message we have is so unbelievably enchanting. Years ago, I remember having an evangelistic conversation with someone, and at a certain point in the conversation, the topic of Jesus came up, and so based upon how things were going, I felt comfortable to ask my friend, who do you think Jesus was? And I was prepared to give an argument to go into what C.S. Lewis described as the Lord, liar, or lunatic argument, but my friend said, I don't know, I've never thought about it. And there was a light bulb moment for me of realizing the need to start further back, to not assume any categories or interest, and to be able to try to break through the sense of apathy we have, the constant dullness of the soul because of the diversions and distractions that we've talked about, that we need to sometimes break through. I think evangelism and sharing about Jesus today will be far less a matter of giving information or winning an argument and far more a matter of an awakening of the soul. C.S. Lewis said, "You and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness which has been laid upon us for nearly 100 years. Almost our whole education has been directed to silencing this shy, persistent inner voice." What he calls there the shy, persistent inner voice is what I'm talking about as the ache. It's what you will feel if you slow down enough to take away the diversions and distractions and think about that ultimate question I put out there, am I happy? It's what I would think about when, before we moved to where we live now in Tennessee, we lived in California. And the particular part of California we lived in was very beautiful, not much air pollution. You could see the night sky very clearly. And we had bought a trampoline for our kids, so I would lie on the trampoline and look up at the stars at night. I would plan to do it for 10 minutes before I went to bed to sort of calm my mind. I'd end up sometimes being out there for about an hour, just enthralled by the beauty of these stars. If you ever just stop and look at the stars, they're so beautiful. And they have a particular effect upon you that's good. And one day it just occurred to me that until the modern West and until disenchantment, this is what everybody did at night.
You just slept under the stars. You see the stars every night. And today we look at screens every night. And it has an opposite effect. Stars make the world feel small. Stars make the world feel big. Screens make the world feel small. I have to believe that's affecting our souls in ways. But that is that deep inner thirst and longing that we need to speak to. And one of the opportunities that we have is to press our non-Christian friends to really consider if their worldview can account for beauty. In some cases, for example, some of the most strictly secular perspectives actually may be borrowing elements of beauty that are difficult to instantiate within the limits of their worldview. It's very hard to make sense of any kind of transcendent beauty within a strictly materialistic worldview. Take the idea of love. Most of us want to think that love matters, that love is significant, and that love is good in a robust sense. But in a strictly materialist worldview, love is explained purely by the process of evolution. It's simply there because it helped our animal ancestors survive. If you really face that and you really look at it, it's hard to live with. That's true of that one aspect of our existence. There's so many others we could trace out in a similar way. And we want to invite people to say, can you make peace with that worldview? Can you live with that? As we're nearing the end, let me say, do two final things, and then we'll start to land the plane and have some time for discussion. First, I want to give a clear articulation of what is the hope that Jesus offers as a response to what we've called modern disenchantment. And that is, again, this feeling of generalized despair because of the loss of transcendence that human beings have always needed to navigate this crazy world we live in. I want to give that, and then I want to give a final image of how a friend of mine experienced that. How does Jesus provide an antidote to modern despair? Remember that word hope that I brought up at the beginning? Some of you are followers of Jesus like myself. Some of you may be just open to Christianity, exploring Christianity. Some of you may be against Christianity. But what those of us who follow Jesus believe is that Jesus is the fundamental and transcendent hope that makes sense of life in this world. And we think there is a God who has made us all. And we think that he's come into the world in the person of Jesus. And through his death and resurrection, he's effected a way for us to be restored to our proper relationship with our Creator. And that is the solution to all of our problems. Specifically, the hope that we have from that is the word resurrection. The New Testament teaches that Jesus rose from the dead, and that those who trust in Jesus will also share in that resurrection. And let me just take a moment as we finish to press the sheer wonder and happiness of that into our hearts a little bit. For those of us who believe that, to encourage you with this. For those of us who are open to consider that, to invite you to contemplate this. Consider the fact that when Jesus rose from the dead, he retained the scars on his physical body. In Luke 24, the disciples think he's a ghost, and so he invites them to actually touch his body to verify his own identity. He's saying, look, you can touch my wrists. You can see that this is, in fact, me. In John's account, Thomas, doubting Thomas, touches his side because that's where he was stabbed with a spear. And the idea here is to verify his identity so they can touch his physical body. That means the scars are still there. Just to prove it for sure, he then eats a fish, which means the resurrected body of Jesus can eat. This is a reminder that heaven, where if you and I trust in Jesus, we will have a resurrected body. There will be eating in heaven. It will be a physical place ultimately. But the point for now is to say, Jesus still has the scars. Now think about this. That is the character of the hope that we have if Jesus really did rise from the dead. If Jesus rose from the dead, it means that evil isn't simply erased out of reality. If Jesus rose from the dead, it means that evil will be turned to good. The scars are still on his body. It doesn't make Good Friday no longer have happened, but actually it turned it into the greatest good, namely our salvation. Now here's the thrilling news. For every single person who trusts in Jesus, that will be true for our suffering. It won't merely be ended when we go to be with Jesus after our life in this world is over. It will be turned to glory and good. think of the experiences you've had in this world that seem so terrible, and we might say, understandably, how could any good come from this? But we've got the paradigm with Jesus. The worst thing that ever happened was his crucifixion, and God turned that to good. If he can do that, he can do that for the suffering in our lives. If Jesus rose from the dead, those of us who trust in Jesus, the worst things will be turned to good, and actually our happy moments in this world are just an anticipation. Think of this. Think of a happy moment in your life, maybe an idyllic moment in nature, maybe a moment from childhood, maybe reconciliation with a friend, maybe when you wake up as a little child and remember that it's Christmas morning. Anybody remember that feeling? Maybe when you're pursuing your spouse and you first realize that they love you back in return. Happy moments like that. There are, if Jesus rose from the dead, they're a little foretaste. They're a little whisper saying the same thing that those leaves are saying to me through the wind at night, that there's something beyond this world. That's not just a hope, that's the best possible hope, and it's a hope that people around us are absolutely desperate for right now. So if all of this, to land it all, we can just say this much. For every single one of us, wherever we're coming from, if Jesus rose from the dead, there's a hope that can make the difference for us. And we should feel an urgency to talk about that hope with others right now, because there's a lot of despair and a lot of disenchantment floating around us. Final image of that, I had a friend who got to the point after studying existentialist philosophy, concluding that this life really is meaningless, that there really is a matter of despair and disenchantment, and he was at the point of being ready to take his own life. On his way to do so, he was stopped and arrested by the sheer beauty of nature around him. And the thought that came to him is, if there's such beauty out there, if there's such order out there in these blades of grass and branches on trees, maybe there's an answer for the pain in here. And he kept going, and eventually he met a Christian who talked to him about the hope of Jesus. And he invited Christ into his life, and it changed everything, as it has for so many of us. What I draw from that is, think of how many people are there right now all around us, but they've never had someone come along and share that hope with them. And we need to have eyes open to see the despair that's around us so we can share the hope that we have.
Let's give Gavin a round of applause.
Oh, thanks.